So in the sermon, we'll be painting perhaps a sort of slightly broader picture of art, the kind of biblical principles behind art. We're also going to slightly redefine what we describe as art. Because art is a good term, but it doesn't necessarily always include things like jewellery making, or baking, or carpentry, or mechanics, or even science, in a sense. So we're going to sort of redefine it and call it this instead. So we're going to say, created to enjoy creativity. When you read the account of creation in Genesis, you see that creation itself goes from being described as good to being described progressively as very good by God. But even after God has effectively finished his work in creation, what you notice is that man's job, man's work, has only just begun. Look at Genesis 1:28 with me. It says this, God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground. The principle sort of stated there in verse 28 is often described technically as the cultural mandate. It's this idea that God has given man and woman his creation, and it's their job to then subdue it. So God effectively, in a sense, finished his work in creation. Of course, he still upholds creation by his hand, but he's also then given it to man and woman to tender it, to have power over it, to have dominion over it, to subdue it. Effectively, he's kind of given man and woman the garden, and now it's their job to tender the garden. That's the kind of idea that it's got. So God is the head gardener. He's done the landscaping, he's done all the work, and then he sort of gives it to us as sort of assistant gardeners, people who just sort of do the digging as such. So that's the sort of principle there in chapter 1, verse 28. And then what we see is the principle in practice. If you look over to chapter 2, we see that God gives man and woman a job. So chapter 2, verse 19 says, now the Lord God had formed out of the ground all the wild animals and all the birds in the sky. He brought them to the man to see what he would name them. And whatever the man called each living creature, that was its name. And of course, later on, man also names woman. And when you read the account of God creating, and then when you look back to how Adam does it, in terms of naming, you see a sort of pattern emerge. Man effectively takes the same approach to his naming ceremony as God did. So if you look at Genesis 1 with me again. In Genesis 1, looking at sort of verse 9, we see that firstly God divides. He divides the dry land from the water. And then in verse 10, God names it. He says, one he shall call land, one he shall call sea. And then a bit like a building surveyor, God then sort of looks at it and assesses it. It says, and God saw. And then you see, God effectively approves of it. The assessment has been carried out successfully, and all looks good, he says. Effectively, it was good. And then when you turn to the man with his sort of funny naming ceremony of both the animals and the woman later on, you see he does particularly take quite a similar approach to how God did it. So look at chapter 2, verse 19 to 23. Adam starts by dividing. So he uses these categories, livestock, bird, beast, and then later, of course, flesh of my flesh. Adam then names them. He sort of says, that one I'll call a sheep, that one a pigeon, that one a bunny rabbit, and that one woman. Perhaps not so sort of dogmatically like that there. And then verse 23, Adam then assesses it. He does the building surveyor job. So he says of woman, for example, she is bone of my bone. She's been taken out of me. And then finally, Adam approves of it by expressing it. He says this of woman. Now, our NIV translation doesn't quite hit it as accurately as it perhaps could. The ESV says this instead. this at last is bone of my bone. Adam's been waiting for a companion, waiting for a friend. And then he says, this at last is my friend. And note the way he expresses it. The first recorded words of Adam, the first recorded words of man are a piece of poetry. It's a song. It's not matter of fact, it's a piece of poetic poetry. So what you see is Adam very much takes a similar kind of pattern to what God did in terms of creating. There's that similar kind of sort of divide, name, assessing, approves, expressing sort of pattern. And it's very much like father, like son. You have a creator with a big capital C, and then you have Adam with a little c. In a sense, God has created the overall creation, and then God gives it over to man and woman as a sort of little sub-creation, as it were. We'll come back to the idea of a sub-creation. It might take some more explaining. But in the first kind of instance, when we look at this kind of pattern that Adam followed, we see a couple of things emerge that I think are particularly helpful for us as we come to consider the area of creativity. So firstly this, Adam worked with what God had already created. Adam worked with what God had already created. Very simply, the living creatures were there in front of him, and then he names them. So they're already there, then he names them. So he's using what God has already given him. The incredibly successful film composer Hans Zimmer, famous for things like Pirates of the Caribbean, the Batman films, Inception, also Video Killed the Radio Star, says that he's never ever amazed when he sits down at a piano. Because when he sits down at a piano to compose, the notes are there, ready and waiting. He doesn't have to craft the physics of each note. They're just there, waiting effectively in space and time for somebody to come along and kind of roll their fingers over them. They are there, existing, ready to be played. And he says it never ever fails to amaze him. So his job is not to craft the note, but to put them in the right order. That's what he does for a job. And that's effectively what Adam has done with the animals. They were there, ready to be named. Adam just had to play the right notes. Secondly, we also see that Adam is indeed creative. A basic principle of any kind of art, of any form, is that you create something new. Nobody's ever done it before, effectively. And an artist can basically imagine something, and then they have the capability to make it. So whatever they do, even if it's kind of a close resemblance of another thing, it's new, isn't it? A painter takes his brush and puts it onto a canvas in a different way to anybody else who's ever done it before. It's effectively original. It's a new thing. And that's what Adam does. He calls the animals by new names because they never had names in the first place. So he names them. He is effectively creative in that sense. He's doing something original. When we then sort of pull those two ideas together, particularly following the sort of pattern of how God went about it in the first place, what we see, very simply, is that a creative person takes something God has made and then does something different with it. So a creative person might take some grapes and turn it into wine. A creative person might bend the laws of physics into a beautiful melody. A creative person is somebody who can take everyday words that we use all the time and craft it into a poem or a song. A creative person is somebody who can take some planks of wood and some bricks and cement and build a house. A creative person is somebody who can take two slices of bread and some cheese and make a cheese sandwich. So an artist or a craftsman or a creative person basically takes what God has made and then does something new with it. So when you are making your cheese sandwich for your packed lunch tomorrow, you are following the principle of the cultural mandate of Genesis 1:28. When you make a work of art, you are following that principle. You are taking what God has made, subduing it, and then making something new with it. And the way you go about that is very similar to the way God went about it in the first place. So we have this sort of principle of Genesis 1:28, subdue the earth. You then see in this sort of funny naming ceremony, Adam gives names to the animals. He perhaps, I know, threw a bottle of champagne on a rope at them, I don't know. But you then kind of see that's what he's going. So you see man at work in subduing God's creation. Man, in a sense, is a sort of sub-creator. The creator with a little c. Not the head gardener, but the assistant gardener. Now, we obviously have to be careful because you could kind of go wacky on that idea a little bit. But I think it is a sort of helpful idea to help us understand what sort of creativity looks like. To perhaps understand it in an artistic manner, we'll look at a poem. It's a piece of poetry that is, I think, really touches the nail on the head with this idea of subduing creation. It's a poem by this chap. Could anybody tell me who that chap is? Tolkien, writer famous for Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, and many others. It's a poem that's got a slightly weird name. It's called Mythopoeia. He was that kind of guy. Don't worry about the name. But if you want to search for it later, Mythopoeia. Tolkien wrote this poem to a friend of his. He's had a conversation with a friend of his this particular night. And his friend was very much what you'd call a rationalist. He was somebody who basically believed in the sort of matter of fact. He believed in what you could logically see and understand, but nothing more. So the idea of God is very much pushed out of the picture, for the most part. And the idea of sort of a bigger, higher meaning to life wasn't on there for his friend of his. And he wrote this poem as an argument to him, to say, well, actually, don't you think there could be more to life than this? His friend said that myths were a load of rubbish, that they were just false lies and just there was no meaning in them whatsoever. So Tolkien decided to write his friend a poem to kind of argue this out. This is the opening sort of few lines. It says this: you look at trees and label them just so. For trees are trees and growing is to grow. You walk the earth and tread with solemn pace, one of the many minor globes of space. A star's a star, some matter in a ball, compelled to courses mathematical. So Tolkien starts this poem by basically summing up the ideas and the beliefs of this friend of his. Stars are just stars, trees are trees, there's nothing more to it. There's no kind of deeper meaning behind anything. They don't say anything greater about themselves. Later on in the poem, Tolkien then touches quite brilliantly on this idea of sort of this sort of cultural mandate, subduing creation. He writes this: and consider the kind of picture of Genesis. Consider the picture of the fall, the kind of commands, the invitations to man, subdue the earth. And this is what he writes: though now long estranged, man is not wholly lost nor wholly changed. Disgraced he may be, yet is not dethroned, and keeps the rags of lordship once he owned. Man, sub-creator. So there you sort of see that picture of the fall quite clearly, I think, there. Long estranged, man is not wholly lost nor wholly changed, but he is disgraced. But he still kind of wears these rags of lordship. And you sort of see this idea of sort of a sub-creation, sort of subduing creation. Now, for Tolkien himself, what it meant to effectively subdue creation was exactly this: to write poetry, to write myths and legends, to write stories that would ultimately perhaps give people a glimpse of what God is like. He goes on to write this. Gets a bit more poetic here. Though all the crannies of the world we filled with elves and goblins, though we dared to build gods and their houses out of dark and light, and sowed the seed of dragons, it was our right. Used or misused, the right has not decayed. We still make by the law in which we're made. So God has commanded that we subdue the earth. And for Tolkien, that's what that looked like. in practice. And this subduing is effectively a creative act. And whether it's writing a piece of poetry or a sculpture or listening to your favourite music, it's effectively all subduing God's creation, and that's a creative act. Now, I mentioned earlier that art can be incredibly powerful. And this, I think, is a prime example of the power of art and how God can use the little pens and ink of a poet. Tolkien wrote this poem on the 19th of September, 1931, in the evening, after having this conversation with his rationalist friend. This friend of his went by the name of C.S. Lewis. And a week after Tolkien wrote that poem to his friend Lewis, they had a conversation, and C.S. Lewis famously said for the first time, he came to know that Christianity was in fact a true myth. A myth that really happened. So there in one poem you see a Christian poet describing what it looks like to subdue creation. And you also see through it the power that art can have. You just have to sort of wonder at the influence that that little poem written by Tolkien that night had had on the whole of God's kingdom through bringing C.S. Lewis. So I hope we've sort of seen a big picture, basic principle of creativity. It's subduing God's creation, and you do that by sort of creating things, taking what God has made and turning them into wine, that kind of thing.